Hello and welcome to this discussing episode. Today we are having a chat. I was going to do a whole series of innuendos for this one, but the play allows that only 50% of the time. The play is called Dick of Devonshire, and the, shall we say, the A plot of the play does definitely lean into a whole series of innuendo and jokes that I have a whole list prepared. But the B plot of the play is actually quite problematic and quite troubling, so I'm actually going to pull back on my witty discourse. I say witty, I don't know, some people disagree, and keep this a fairly serious take. Do look in the show description for content warnings for later on in the episode, but we're going to hopefully stay relatively PG and safe for the first half or so as we talk about Dick of Devonshire by Well to Be Discussed. I have a wonderful guest to talk about the play with a brand new edition coming out. It's not been an easy play to get copies of previously, so it's delightful to have a reassuringly expensive Revels edition appearing very, very soon. So without further ado, my guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Thank you very much. I'm Kate Ellis. I'm the editor of the forthcoming edition of Dick of Devonshire. I am a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Exeter at the moment in the business school. Plot twist, I'm not in the English literature department. And my PhD, I undertook with Tracy Hill and Ian Gadd through Bath University. And this was one of the plays that came up through that research, and I've carried it on since then. So looking forward to discussing it.
Tracy Hill, a long time friend of the pod, often talking about civic pageantry and various other figures here. So Dick of Devonshire is in part based on actual historical events, and in fact, one person's first-person account of the events that he himself was involved in. So could you just sort of give us a little overview of the play itself? How does it come to us, and what's it sort of doing?
So it's based on an expedition to Cadiz that the English fleet took in 1625. And coming out of that expedition were three main first-hand accounts. So we have the journal of the Lord Admiral of the Fleet, Lord Cecil. We have the secretary to the fleet, Sir John Glanville. And then we have a pamphlet written by one of the foot soldiers, which is unusual in itself, but I think the reasons for that will become clear later on, Richard Peake, who is the eponymous hero of the play. The expedition was undertaken to emulate an earlier expedition in 1596 that was glorious. And it has gone down in English folklore as one of those golden age seafaring adventures. And when Charles I succeeded the throne in 1625, he was keen to sort of repeat that, to recreate it. So where his father, James I, had followed a policy of appeasement with Spain, Charles had quite an embarrassing encounter with the Spanish through his attempt to secure a marriage alliance with the Spanish Infanta in 1623. And trying to come back from that, he was starting to pursue a more aggressive foreign policy with Spain. And so this 1625 expedition was set up to try and recreate the glory days and really make his name. And it went horribly wrong. The fleet was made up of more merchant ships and collier ships than it was naval ships. When they landed in Cadiz, they didn't land with any food or any drink, so they had to raid local houses where they had access to plentiful vats of wine, no water, and then the obvious consequences of that occurred. The troops were drunk, they were ordered back onto the ship to re-embark. They then tried to intercept Spanish gold treasure fleet. They somehow, word had got out to the Spanish fleet, they came in a different way, the English fleet missed them and limped home. So the expedition itself did not go well. But there's one glimmer within that which forms the basis of this play. So Richard Peake himself was captured by the Spanish. He was taken as a prisoner of war. And when he went to trial, he was challenged to fight a duel against three Spanish men armed with swords. And he could pick his weapon of choice. He chose a quarterstaff, a pike, which I think is coincidental with his name. So Richard Peake, and then he became Dick Pike in the play. I think that's coincidental and serendipitous. But he fought off these three Spanish soldiers. He was declared a hero. He was offered Spanish citizenship, and he declined that to swear allegiance to Charles I, returned to England a hero, and was presented to Charles I in London, where he gave him a copy of the pamphlet that he'd written up, presumably on his way back, of his exploits. And that then became the source material for the play.
Yeah. So just going back over the sort of that historical context, this is a play and events following on from, you mentioned earlier, the Spanish match. And of course, we've done a fair amount on the Spanish match, as we've done a lot on A Game at Chess, which at time of recording hasn't been released fully on the podcast yet. But we've already done a lot on The Game at Chess, which is dealing with that sort of aftermath and that sense of what's going on towards the very end of James's reign. And then, say, a new monarch comes to the throne, and that first year isn't very successful for him. Beyond, there's plague. He doesn't even get a proper royal entry or anything like that. All that has to get cancelled. And then this, and that sense of grabbing what you can out of the ashes with this story, and the pamphlet Richard Peake writes is really interesting. And we were speculating when we were looking at it ourselves, it's a really interesting text. It's a really engaging text. And actually how it was written out, we were sort of wondering, it feels very spoken. So I was wondering, has he read it to someone to actually write for him physically, or whether I don't know how well educated we know he was, could he write? I'm assuming that he couldn't, but I assume we don't really know the answers to these things, but suspicions, do we have any thoughts?
Well, we don't know very much about him at all beyond what we find in that pamphlet. He was a man from Tavistock in Devon, which is actually where my interest came from. So I live in Plymouth. I was brought up in Plymouth, about half an hour away from Tavistock in the southwest of the UK. And the parish registers there don't start until 1620. We don't even know when he was born. We can't tell how old he was at the time of that voyage. I do suspect another hand. I don't have any evidence for that. But in creating that pamphlet, and I have some reservations about the date on which he said he landed back in Foyers, given in that pamphlet. It's given as the 23rd of April, St. George's Day, which seems quite convenient.
Yes.
Yes.
But as a humble brag goes, it's a really interesting text, because he is quite humble throughout a lot of it. And he's talking about good luck and fortune. And the actual depiction of the initial engagements do read quite believably. We're just going to the shot everywhere, and it's just carnage, and nobody really knows what's going on, and that stuff feels very believable. Whereas then you start going later on and going, did all that really happen?
Yes, and when you get into the play, you see some of that tempered, some of that carnage early on, with some scenes of the war cabinet. I don't know if that's the correct term, but the captain and the secretary sort of having these conversations with Pike, who is the Richard Peake in the play. And I suspect those were created rather than faithful depictions. But he certainly warms up, doesn't he, as he goes through the pamphlet? He warms to his theme.
He does. And then, as I say, we get to this question of the adaptation of this turning into a play, which as you were just saying, the question of tempering the action is a question of, how practically can you do a sea battle, and those elements, and what is exaggerated and what is simplified and what is turned into report. So we have a play written relatively soon after this text comes into existence. How does it come to us? What is this text that we have?
So we have one manuscript. That's the only contemporary copy. It's a folio manuscript in the Egerton 1994 manuscript, bound with 13 other manuscript plays and one mask. We know that at one point that manuscript was the property of William Cartwright Jr., who was an actor and later bookseller in 17th century England, and he bequeathed his collection to Dulwich College upon his death in 1686. That's all we have. We have some later printed texts from the 19th century, but nothing contemporaneously.
But around that, we don't really, or we didn't really, have an idea of necessarily who wrote the play, who played the play, where was it appearing, what playhouse. It's sort of this big gap of, we've got a text that, as I say, has been edited if not necessarily in living memory, but, you know, has sort of circulated. But we don't really have much more. And you've been digging into potential options as to what's going on. So, talk through who, what, and why.
Okay. All right. So the manuscript itself, as you say, it doesn't have an author's name appearing anywhere on it, doesn't have a date appearing anywhere on it. It's been something of a mystery, and it's something that scholars have been unpicking for over 100 years. The first thing to say is there's not actually any record of a performance at the time. So I'll come on in a second to talk about clues that you can pick up about who it may have been written for to perform. And I do solemnly believe that it was written to play due to clues within the manuscript. So it was first published in a printed copy at the end of the 19th century by A.H. Bullen. And since then, Thomas Heywood has been cited as the most likely author. He comes up time and time again as the likely author. But then you also find Robert Davenport, James Shirley, and John Ford in the frame. But as scholarship has progressed, it's been possible to do some more work around some of the stylistics of the text. I know you had a guest on recently who talked about that there's only one part of authorship attribution. And I think a lot of the earlier scholarship did look at those patterns of speech and the appearance of couplets and looked at that. But we're now able to complement that with some more stylistics analysis. I used the model put forward by Hugh Craig when he looked at the canon of John Fletcher, and in processing that, he ran 40 marker words into an index system, entered them into a principal component analysis, and then plotted these results onto a scattergraph. So it's really quite scientific. So I replicated that with Dick of Devonshire against the sole authored texts of the other people in the frame, so Heywood, Davenport, Shirley, and Ford. And I did have help with this. I'm not going to take all the credit for that. Barbara Ravelhoff, who very kindly ran through when she was working on the James Shirley texts, and ran Dick of Devonshire through that, and was able to rule Shirley out as a potential author. And my colleagues Heather Frulish and Carol Sutton helped me with the actual technical bits, but we ran it through and we have been able to find that we have one cluster of characters when we run it through against other texts by Thomas Heywood. And so there is no separation in the way that there is in Hugh Craig's earlier model. There is one cluster. And so from that, we're able to quite confidently say, I think, that the author is Thomas Heywood. And in parallel to my own work in this, Brett Greatley Hirsch has also replicated that experiment, and he has also deduced that it's Thomas Heywood. So that's very gratifying. That would have been terrible, yes, if we came out with two different answers. and moreover, we can see that actually the characters in both the main plot and the subplot come out as Thomas Heywood. So we can rule out collaboration on this play as well, and fairly confidently claim that it was a solo authored piece.
Yes, I mean it was interesting when we you know, on the less scientific method of reading the play, of going, you know, well, we don't know anything about this. Anyone feel that there are any other it feels like one person, doesn't it? Yes, it does. That Scrooge McDuck feeling into the gold pile sense, because yeah, it is nice that we're in a situation where we can balance straightforward judgments of with a more scientific approach and apply in different modes and via different, slightly different methodologies, rather than one individual sort of silver bullet sort of situation, which yes, can go horribly wrong.
Yes, absolutely. And once you've done that, once you've anchored Thomas Heywood as the author for the text, you can then do some more detective work, some more analysis to work out some of the further details. So as I mentioned earlier, we know that manuscript was owned by William Cartwright Jr. He acted with the King and Queen of Bohemia's men, with Queen Henrietta Maria's men, and he was also a shareholder with the King's men. So you have to bring those companies into contention. And when you look at the manuscript with which the folio for Dick of Devonshire is bound, you've also got plays in there from Lady Elizabeth's players, Prince Charles's players, and Queen Anne's players. So then if you don't have the authorship, you have seven companies in the frame, and you can't really draw that many conclusions. So the identification of Hayward really helps us here. And we've also got indicators within the text that the play was written for an indoor playhouse. Mm. So if we assume that the play was written shortly after the expedition, so in 1626, 1627, by Hayward for an indoor playhouse, the only options that you have are the Blackfriars and the Cockpit, because Salisbury Court wouldn't open for another 3 years, at which point probably the appetite for this tale has gone. It's faded into the historical past. We don't have any evidence that Hayward wrote for Blackfriars or for the King's Men before 1626. He would go on to write for the King's Men later on when he did the Late Lancashire Witches with Richard Broome. But certainly until 1626, we don't have any record of that. He did write three plays for the Queen Henrietta Maria's Men between 1625 and 1630. We know that William Cartwright Jr. also acted with the Queen Henrietta Maria's Men. And we know that the Queen Henrietta Maria's Men was the resident company at the Cockpit. So we can, through that process of deduction, suspect that that was a play written by Thomas Hayward for Queen Henrietta Maria's Men to be performed at the Cockpit. But we don't have a record that that performance ever happened.
No, and I think that for us as a group performing these things, that's a lovely inference that we can play with, because we could say, well, let's try and do those plays within that orbit and see how they flow together. Mm. That gives you something to play with without necessarily saying this is absolutely true. This is absolutely, you know, I never trust people who say things are absolutely this or that. It's very tedious. And that's to the listeners, not to you. anyone who's certain, do not trust them. So, yes, you were talking about indicators that is an indoor play. What sort of indicators were you drawing from the text in that sense?
For a military play, we don't have any battle scenes. Mm. We don't have any scenes for large crowds. We don't have any cannons. Mm. And when we do have stage directions for a battle, they tend to be sounded by cornets rather than trumpets. Mm. So from that, drawing an inference that it was probably written to be performed indoors.
Yes, there are people taken out on stage, but they're sort of taken out by snipers, really, rather than anything else, which is an adjustment from the source material as well, which is quite interesting, that there seems to be some specific design in terms of understanding of what the playing company specifically can do rather than what the source says, because when Dick is captured, in the play, for the listeners at home, when Dick is captured, in the pamphlet, there's a horse involved. The horse gets mentioned. There's a horse over there. But the staging doesn't integrate a horse into its action. It is no Thomas of Woodstock. So when presenting a Rebels edition, you're not just dealing with the text, you're also sort of dealing also with its afterlives. Does this play have much of an afterlife after that initial moment? Are there modern performances or even semi-modern performances or anything vaguely touching on this at all?
I haven't found one. So I would be really interested to speak to you, actually, with your sort of performance perspective, because we don't have anything that I've come across for Dick of Devonshire to see how those performative aspects work out. So really interested to hear anything that's come up on that.
I mean, we've done an initial first look exploring session reading it. We also read 3-1. We did enjoy a lot of the pamphlet, occasionally slightly more than the play itself. We were sitting there going, oh, they should have done that bit. It's just slightly frustrating.
Yes, because those really dramatic pieces in the pamphlet don't make it across.
No.
And there's a whole paragraph in there about a raid on the English fleet. And there are soldiers who are having their ears cut off, their noses cut off, their heads being used as footballs. Nowhere in that play does that make an appearance. Mm. You do see it in Glanville's diary. So it is recorded as a factual occurrence within that raid. And yet that is one of the few deviations, because one thing to say is that the play follows that pamphlet so closely for the majority of it, that when you get those deviations, you have to think that they're significant.
We had a number of thoughts on that. And I mean, some of it, I think, is pragmatic. I think some of it was the way it was put together. I think there's also a question about how much of the Dick plotline, and we'll get to the subplot anon, I say the subplot, the other plot, is that tonally, what is the play trying to do with it? Because if it is, isn't Dick great, which is sort of what the play does an awful lot. I just kept saying, what a guy. Because that's pretty much what everybody does throughout the play. If you're going for a Errol Flynn-style daring do, having the mutilation of corpses and the full rigors of war doesn't fit. So I wonder whether there was a tonal tidy up there. The other question actually that arose, which was the suggestion in the room that it was a bit too close to the events to really dig into those details, in the sense that, you know, potentially there's some people in the audience whose relatives might have been in that action or something. In the same way as if there's a tragic event today, you won't have dramas about it immediately. There'll be a sort of cooling off period. And that was a suggestion that maybe in a pamphlet that was fine, but on stage it wouldn't play.
No, and I think you're right on both of those. In terms of the nearness as well, I mean, when the troops came back, there were no provisions. The expedition had been such a disaster, there was no funding to return these soldiers to their homes. So a lot of them were still billeted with families in Plymouth. So yes, if you're celebrating that and you haven't had your family member back, it's going to cause ructions.
We know early modern plays could happily revel in carnage. But again, there's often a sort of, if it's a recent historical event, it's usually a sort of, there's a 10-year span or something, you know, the massacre at Paris and, you know, the Alarum for England, you know, they're reporting really horrible things, but they happen far away to other people. And it was, you know, usually there's 10 years or more went by, whereas this is hot off the press. But that doesn't mean, I say, that necessarily that's in play. But also, because this plot of Dick, based on true story, has been merged with this other plot that is tonally, totally different. And he's sort of, I suspect the reason why it hasn't had any major revivals is that content warning, we're getting to that point now. So if you'd any listeners who don't want to listen about sexual violence, please, please leave now. We have this subplot, which is about a rape. That's hard to put in to deal with when you've got Errol Flynn, you know, and there are moments of seriousness in the Dick plotline, but it's pretty light. And then we have this other plotline, which is not coming from the same place at all.
And it is that second plot that actually a lot of the criticism of Dick of Devonshire highlights, because it does seem to sit uncomfortably. The two tales sit very uncomfortably together. And there's been some speculation about which order the plots came in. So whether the main Richard Peake storyline was bolted on to the second plot of sexual coercion and assault to try and give it a currency to get it onto the stage, or whether it was added afterwards to try and temper some of that. I don't know. You see criticism going both ways. But I think the interesting thing about it is that they don't connect at all until the very final scene, where you find characters from both plots in the same trial. And that's the only point at which they converge. And even then, they're not conversing with each other. Those plots are still very separate.
And the thing about there are two problems, big problems. One is that the two plots don't converge. So you get this whiplash effect. It's not like you're in a play like The Changeling, where, yes, you have two plot lines that don't really converge, but at least they're tonally similar and they are thematically connected. There is no thematic connection here. But also, especially for a modern audience, even more so, the ending for this plot is so awful. You know, it could end in a satisfactory fashion, in the sense of, if they do actually follow through with, well, he's got to be executed and die now, which is mooted. And you're sitting there going, everyone's going, kill him. He's a horrible, horrible man. It's also a problem of the B plot. I'm going to call it the B plot, because it is that, it's the best way of putting this, it fluctuates quite wildly from scene to scene as to what it's trying to do. Some of the scenes, individual scenes, are really good, and there's some really interesting psychology. And if you want to dig into the questions of coercion and patriarchy and misogyny and sexual violence, there's a lot of really interesting material there that works. There are some of the psychology for some of the men as they're going, well, our reputation of our family is more important. Oh, but he's clearly getting, no, we can't believe he's guilty, because if he's guilty, that makes us look bad. And you're sitting there going, okay, this is how these structures perpetuate. This is really interesting. But then you look at the very first scene with all of those characters, and they're all sort of cardboard cutout, la, 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 la. And it doesn't quite fit. And it feels like that first scene was going somewhere else. And there's someone twists the wheel and says, no, it has to be more than what is going on here. And then the central bastard sort of try to twist and make him into this Machiavellian figure of, with a plot line with his servant, and it's sort of and saying his father's dead for no readily apparent reason. Yes. And you're going, why?
A weird comedy. There's some weird comic moments within that, that plot as well, from Bazzano, the servant character. Even at the point of attack, I think, and coming out of there, there's some lines that read as comic lines, but in the most horrific plot. Because I think what struck me when I first read it was that coercion follows quite closely the coercion in A Game at Chess with the White Queen's pawn. And at one point I thought, well, this is a mirror image, but then it takes it further. Mm. So I think in chess, it stays as coercion. It becomes something more in the B plot of this. And yes, then becomes that, it seems to pick up all those motifs, doesn't it? Because then it starts picking up those motifs about the reverend habit and sanctity and monastic robes and disguise and all of those things that we have seen before in chess start to play out here.
Yes, I mean, I don't think any of... I think one of the reasons why it appears in a play like this is it is such a prevalent plot line in basic shape. Sexually violent plot lines, but have been done better elsewhere. I think that we were fascinated by the comedy servant in that sequence, because he was quite a well-written comedy servant as well. There was going, okay, some of these jokes are sort of terrible, but they're sort of working. And in juxtaposition with what else is going on here, that's having a very interesting effect. And again, we were thinking of The Changeling again, where there are these sort of comic moments that are quite disturbing, but it's not fully integrated and it doesn't really have a thesis. And then it ends with, oh, you can just marry him, it'll be fine, which is, a very conventional early modern thing. But killing him would have been a slightly more satisfactory thing.
And she does opt to kill him first, doesn't she? And then she's talked out of it. So she's given the choice, and then it's no choice at all.
No. There is a sort of simple out there of just saying, yeah, kill him, and then cut the rest. The other option I had was Dick's final line was, where must I leave my pistolette? He just shoots him. It's like suddenly the Dick plotline makes sense. He's the only one with the moral courage to actually just kill him because he's an outsider. And it's like, none of these are satisfactory outcomes. And we are being a bit flippant here, but that's sort of the inevitable reaction of this kind of thing, of just trying to decide what do you do with a text like this? Because that's our blessing and our curse is, you know, we've got to do something with this. We are pledged to do every play in some fashion. In the case of Dick of Devonshire, it's the A plot all the way, supplemented by the pamphlet. That was pretty much the conclusion we came, is you could do a really interesting play about Richard Peake using some of the pamphlet as effectively inner voice narration with the scenes in the play, and then basically just quietly pretend the B plot doesn't exist and remove it. And that would make an entertaining and occasionally interesting evening of theatre. I'm not saying we won't attempt to do something with the play as it's written, but it's a big ask. And the audience needs a seminar before we start. we did this with A Game at Chess to a degree, but A Game at Chess, at least it's assault averted.
And it's cohesive. It fits within that main action. It all comes down to those Anglo-Spanish relationships, doesn't it, that are explored throughout. Whereas this, to put this play into performance, you need to try and find that cohesion. You need to make that second plot fit within the main plot. And I'm quite interested as well in writing. I don't have any evidence for this, but part of me thinks, was that pamphlet used because it enabled Hayward to really quickly write that plot? Because it's taken so much on the pamphlet that then gave him time. Was that second plot the one that he really wanted to focus on? and just layered the Richard Peake stuff on the top because it was already there.
Hayward has some form with, again, plots involving sexual violence in various forms. The difficulty with that, in the sense that Hayward wrote a lot.
Yes.
You know, he affirmed that he wrote a lot, and it turns out, actually, with a fair amount of analysis, he did write rather a lot, actually. So sometimes actually trying to find patterns within Hayward's work, because he writes a lot. He writes often quite episodically. I mean, this isn't an episodic text in that sense. And yeah, I think there is a sense he's just page to stage with the pamphlet. I mean, the problem with the pamphlet is it doesn't really have a shape.
No.
That is one of the problems, you know, in turning it into drama, is bloke gets captured, bloke has fight, bloke is freed.
Bloke wins.
Yeah, and that's basically it. And those are exciting scenes. And the play sort of tries to do something with, almost does something with the sort of his relationships with the various women who, you know, sort of take pity on him or are, you know, quite nice to him in various ways. And it doesn't quite move into a romantic mode or anything like that, but it's sort of hinted or played in a way that the pamphlet doesn't do at all.
I mean, Hayward does play in a lot of his work with the idea of hospitality and the power structures that are shown through hospitality. And Catalina, quite unexpectedly, I think, shows sympathy to Richard Peake as a prisoner and brings him clothes in prison and incurs the wrath of her husband for doing so. I think the portrayal of the Spanish in this play is ambiguous in a way that it's not in A Game at Chess. It's quite clear in that. It's literally black and white in A Game at Chess. But you start to see those ambiguities in this play.
There is an interesting plot line for Don John that doesn't quite come across. Everybody else is sort of quite nice to him, generally speaking. The jailer's a bit shirty with him, but everybody else sort of goes, you know, he is more noble than he seems to be. What a guy. Whereas Don John, of course, hates him because he captured him initially. And of course, his wife is going, thank you for not killing my husband.
Well, he has him at sword point? I'm saying sword point, and now I'm thinking, well, why didn't he
use
his sword
him.
In his central combat? But he has him at the end of a weapon and pardons him, doesn't he, Richard Peake, and then is double-crossed.
Yes, the musketeers turn up. 12 or 14, depending on which text you're looking at. And so, okay, our budget doesn't run to 14. You can have 12. Everybody who's not on stage in that scene turns up with a hat on.
Maybe with some ears in them.
Yeah, that's a plotline that could be developed quite interesting. I think the psychology of someone whose honour has been slightly besmirched and then who sort of just goes against your central character in a slightly over-the-top way. I think there's something you can do with that. And I think in performance you can do that. I think there's a lot there. It's just it could do with another draft to just bring that out, actually, and give him a bit more interiority. I think the thing about the Dick plotline, it is very skimming the surface. It's doing the plot beats from the pamphlet, as you say. And not unentertainingly. I think it's very interesting.
There's not much emotion in there.
No.
Not much emotion.
I mean, depth. Dick gets that emotive speech when the soldier dies in his arms.
Yes.
And, you know, you can hear the violins playing in the background. And I say, the B-plot is attempting a sort of psychological thing. And some of those moments work really well. But it just seems to veer from one mode to another. And then it just sort of just throws in this additional, my brother killed my father, the father who's not dead. I mean, how did he think that was going to play out?
Yeah, you do get, there are several moments in this play where you just think, why didn't you see that coming? So that, yeah.
I think there is a really good production of the Dick plotline. I think there's something that can be done there that would be really entertaining and really interesting. I think we could do an event focused on Dick of Devonshire as a text, which we would, say, curate and signpost everything very clearly in advance. If only because it's a manuscript play, and they're always quite interesting as well, in the sense that they haven't gone through that additional editorial process that happens with print.
And even just to hear some of those nuances in a reading rather than a full production, just to hear those lines spoken rather than on the page, because I do firmly believe it was written to be performed.
Oh, yeah, this is clearly designed as a performance piece, and it functions that way. It would make no sense as a closet drama.
No.
You know, or anything else
like
that.
And it would be unnecessary, wouldn't it? Because you've got the pamphlet. You don't need another play that that just repeats.
That process of bringing it to a Revels edition and getting it, you know, and the amount of work that goes into making that happen, bringing it to a different audience, a modern audience, even in print, is really important for plays like this. In the sense that, say, if you want to go on Amazon and buy this play, you can't really at the moment. But well, you can now.
December 2024, you can.
Yes.
No, I think that the last printed edition was the Malone Society edition, which is really interesting. And the introductory note there, which really details the manuscript as a material object, is really interesting. But we don't have a critical edition that interrogates the text and brings those contextual notes in.
Mm. I'm always surprised in performances. Same happened with Game at Chess, is actually things that you think are more of a problem become less of a problem. And things that you hadn't noticed were a problem suddenly leap up and bite you. Actually, you don't always know. Even with just a read through, you often don't really understand what a text is doing. And that's always a problem with plays, is that people dismiss plays because they read it and go, oh, that's full of long speeches, yes, or that's full of stuff. And it's like, no, plays do not exist. Play scripts exist and productions of plays exist. But there is no platonic ideal.
No, that's right. There is no one version of a play.
And in that sense, just because we've said, well, we don't think the B plot will work, doesn't mean that somebody else can't look at it and say, well, I've got a spin. I've got an idea. I can make this into a thing. And that's where the imaginative leap is quite important for what we do.
Because the other option is to take that second plot as the main plot and ignore the Richard Peake stuff. Oh, no, I don't know what you call it then. Because Dick of Devonshire doesn't appear in it.
No.
But to look at that as a standalone plot would be really interesting.
Yes. And I say, if it wasn't for the ending, where I don't think an audience would stomach it. I mean, it's a different kind of tragedy. Because again, that's the generic question. What is the genre of this play? And if you split the two parts aside, how would you label the other plot line?
I think it's described, I don't know if it's on the title page, but as a tragicomedy. But that second plot line, the B plot, is going to end in a wedding. It doesn't end on the stage, but that's the ultimate conclusion of that storyline.
But it's not a wedding that anyone wants to happen,
because it's between
a rapist and his victim. And she could kill him. And that's a kind of resolution. Mm. What's really interesting, again, I was talking about the psychology of it all, is, you know, people do believe her, which is quite interesting. People often don't believe the victim in these texts. But when it comes down to this moment of you assaulted my daughter, I believe her. And then he says, well, this is what we're going to do. And she goes, And he shuts her down completely. The men, you know, she doesn't get a say in what's actually happening in that sort of initial exchange. And again, that feels very believable in the way that these dynamics work.
And not everybody believes her.
No.
So she's shut down at the end, but there's a horrible moment when the letter comes through that Eleonora has written to describe her assault.
Enrico's father believes her.
Enrico's brother doesn't, because the letter was delivered by common post, and that in itself is enough to overturn the truth of what she's saying.
Well, also on top of that, he makes that point, you know, we can't believe in it. So it's like there's part of you going, he does believe it, really? He's just looking for reasons to not believe it.
Yes. Which is another. And I bet he wish he believed it when Enrico then accused him of murdering his father, trying to get out of it.
And again, on that whole thing of what do you do with this tonally, we do have someone racked on stage.
Yes.
You know, there is on stage quite brutal violence in that plot line, but they dampen down the violence.
Yes, they take
in the Dick
plotline. Yeah,
we were saying in the pamphlet, you know, the soldiers who are ambushed are mutilated and killed quite brutally. In the play, they're wandering around collecting lemons, and the play doesn't really get across the fact that they're in trouble.
No,
the play just sort of goes, "Oh, we're just having a wander, isn't it fun? We won, didn't we?" And they're looking for lemons, oranges, and lemons, and these snipers just take them down. Which actually makes it feel much more modern as well, because that's the kind of thing we see in a war film.
Yes.
Of the soldier who's thinking the war's over because, you know, the main battle's over, and then is taken out suddenly and his mates are there saying goodbye. And actually, that's one element of that scene where we're going, oh, we've seen this hundreds of times. Mm. And actually, people understand this scene. This scene makes sense to us.
But it also makes it more immediate, because I think in the pamphlet, Richard Peake just comes across the bodies, whereas it brings that danger closer to him, I think, and ups that bravery.
I do love the chat the English fleet have of going, well, we it'd be lovely to save him, but we've got to go. You know, we asked very nicely. They said no.
What else can you do?
Yeah, you know, we got a schedule to keep here, people. And so the play really doesn't get across the fact that the whole thing was a bit of a fiasco. It really sort of makes it feel like it was a bit of derring do, and this chap just got left behind once we'd finished the job. You know, it's mission accomplished type propaganda.
And I don't know actually how far that would have gone down with an audience, because at the time there were libels circulating about Cecil and his complete mismanagement of the expedition, and he starts wheedling about how it's everybody else's fault and now all these libels are coming out about me and it wasn't my fault and it was the wine.
And of course the play has the opportunity to indulge in this sort of 1980s fight scene with a quarterstaff, which he's basically created out of a broom.
Yes.
He's knocked the head off a broom and there we are, that'll do, because that's my weapon of choice because I'm an Englishman, rah.
But that combat gets recreated on YouTube by several martial artists practicing with their quarterstaff. This episode is mentioned less so now. I think a few of the early ones that were up there at the time that I started researching this have gone. I was checking yesterday, but you do still see a lot of these multiple opponent recreations. So it hasn't made it to the stage, but it's made it to YouTube.
well, that's I think that's a perfectly legitimate way of doing it, and you know, we're not averse to that ourselves. We have a certain number of people who are into their combat forms, and that's where they sort of rub their hands, going, "Aha! Yes. We have a scene. We can do something with." It's also interesting in that scene we have almost just plonked straight out of the pamphlet this weird interrogation sequence, and the pamphlet does do all of the backs and forths between as dialogue his interrogation about what the English defenses are like. And of course the logic, and it's made clear in the play, they already know the answers, so it doesn't matter what you say. Yes. So that Dick doesn't come across as a traitor. And it's a really interesting scene. It just doesn't feel right in where it's placed in the action. If it was in a cell, I mean, I know it's coming from the pamphlet and how it was, you know, supposed to have happened, but you could have made that quite a... I suppose it would work in an indoor theatre as well, in the sense it would have a certain claustrophobia of being surrounded by all these opponents and people on the stage. That might feel quite intense, actually. Whereas if you're doing it outdoors, then it wouldn't necessarily feel that way.
And you also have the sort of similar interrogation by the friars in the cell the night before. And again, you get the feeling that they already know those answers, but there's a brilliant bit that isn't, I don't think, in the pamphlet, but it's in the stage play, where that exchange becomes quite sinister. Mm. There are a few asides in that exchange in the play that aren't in the pamphlet about that traitorship.
Yeah, they've sort of moved certain bits that are mentioned, because of course what the play doesn't make clear is they're his translators. In the pamphlet, that's why they're there. They're to translate for him, whereas here it's just like everyone has a universal translator and it's fine. The reason they're there is sort of removed. They're just there for a bit of Protestant trolling, basically. Because they're going, would you like to convert? You're about to die. No, I've called on Christ. And, you know, I didn't need to be all your popish activities. And it's that sense of it going, Hayward latching upon that as a good scene, but not actually bothering to connect it with the rest, probably for doubling reasons, is that the friars are only free for one scene.
Yes.
Because they've got to be somebody else in the next scene or whatever. So, you know, friar habit. We're on a friar habit. There you go. That'll do. Expediency turns up a lot. Any additional thoughts before we wind up?
I think just a rallying cry for some sort of performative exploration of the text, just to really see what that adds, or to see what those complexities are that don't necessarily come through the text. And those nuances would be great.
Right. Well, we've reached that point where if I could ask you to officially plug and tell us all about your edition, where they can find it, and in a nutshell, tell us.
Okay, thank you. So Dick of Devonshire is being published by Manchester University Press as part of their Revels Plays series. Publication is due in December 2024. And this edition, I believe, is the first critical edition with the textual commentary. There's also some appendices where I've tried to bring together any contemporary document that mentions either Richard Peake or Dick of Devonshire. There isn't much, but they split between reportage and commemorative verses. It's quite interesting to look at those and the play in the context of those. And the 3-to-1 pamphlet is in there, of course, as well.
So depending on what point you're listening to this, it will either be definitely out or it's any second now. It's certainly orderable at the point of recording this, even if it's not physically out yet. But for those listening in the future, it is there. And if you're listening in the far future, it will probably also be at a lower price than it is at the time we're recording. I said earlier, Revels editions are reassuringly expensive, certainly when they first come out. But usually once they get into a print-on-demand iteration, a paperback iteration, they come down to a very reasonable price. Otherwise, go to a library. I believe they still have them in some towns. All that remains to thank my wonderful guests for being wonderful. Thank you very much, and goodbye.